Protests continue in Venezuela.
There is 45 people detained in the last hours. One person is killed in state Yaracuy state.
Plus, are fires in Europe linked to Russia?
As European governments look for answers, reports of the attacks are causing anguish among Ukrainian refugees who thought they had come to a safe space.
And later, another devastating landslide, an update from Kyiv, and why Khartoum is not safe for women. Today is Thursday, July 30th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Venezuela's opposition says they have proof that challenger Edmundo González defeated President Nicolas Maduro in Sunday's presidential elections as street demonstrations against Maduro's victory turned deadly. González and opposition leader Maria Corina Machado told reporters on Monday that they received more than 70% of tally sheets from the voting that shows González winning more than 6 million votes, while Maduro had only won a bit more than 2 million votes. Alvaro Algaro reports for VOA's Latin American service. He's on the streets in Caracas.
Okay, there is a lot of people, thousands of people right now in the east of Caracas protesting against what they said it's a fraud committed this Sunday in Venezuela. In a few minutes, the leader, Maria Corina Machado, is coming to the UN office to say to the international people to abide for what is going on in Venezuela. They want a recount of the votes. They don't recognize the elections. There is 45 people detained in the last hours. One person is killed in state Yaracuy state.
Have the protests been violent?
Oh yeah, big time. Very violent. People, it's going out from their houses just to protest. They want recount the votes of the election. A few minutes ago, one political, it's been kidnapped from his house. His name is Freddy Superlano from Voluntad Popular Party.
Alvaro, the opposition says they have proof that Maduro did not win. What is that proof?
Exactly. They have all the proof, all the copies for the votes, every vote, for all the day on Sunday. So they want to recount this and show to the international people, the international observation. Today, the Carter Center representation left the country without present and informed of the situation for security. They left the country.
And what has the reaction of the Maduro government been?
The reaction of Maduro last night, he called to the people to stay in their houses. And he says if the people goes out, it's going to be to jail if people protest. But people, without that, they go out. There is a lot of people, thousands of people every minute. As can you hear the ambience?
Alvaro Algaro reports for Voice of America's Latin American service. He's in Caracas. Alvaro, thank you for your time. Thanks for your reporting. Stay safe out there for us.
Thank you very much for your attention, okay?
Meanwhile, in Europe, as arson attacks disrupt the opening of the Olympics in France, European governments have been saying for weeks that Russia is beginning to carry out sabotage attacks on military and civilian infrastructure across the continent. In London, members of the Ukrainian refugee community were shocked when a warehouse containing aid bound for Ukraine was burned down by British citizens recruited by Russian intelligence services. Henry Wilkins has the story.
An industrial park on the outskirts of London may seem like an unlikely scene for a Russian attack on Ukraine. But in March, say British police, that's what happened. They charged two British men with collaborating with Russian intelligence after a warehouse was allegedly set on fire, destroying it. The facility was owned by a company transporting aid to Ukraine. There has been no plea in the case and no Russian comment. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has warned of an uptick in sabotage attacks by Russia across Europe.
The Kremlin's also been intensifying its hybrid attacks against frontline states, NATO members, setting fire and sabotaging supply warehouses, disregarding sea borders and demarcations in the Baltics, mounting more and more cyber attacks, continuing to spread disinformation.
Juliana Yashova fled her home in Ukraine and came to Britain in 2023. Upon visiting the site of the burned warehouse, she said she was shocked to see something like this on British soil.
And when we see that the result of it being burned to the ground, this is really, really painful. And I think to prevent it, to somehow control much better Russian intelligence in Europe, because it has such deep roots here, it has such long hands.
Similar incidents have been reported in Spain, Germany, which this social media footage purports to show, as well as in France, while Latvia's president and officials from the Netherlands and Lithuania have warned more attacks may be possible. Mark Hanna of the Institute for Global Affairs says incidents like these are consistent with Russia's covert efforts to weaken support for Ukraine.
So if it thinks that these acts of arson and these acts of sabotage will somehow weaken the will of publics in these countries, that is, I think, one of the primary motivations for Russia for carrying out these acts.
German prosecutors have accused Russia of trying to weaken military support for Ukraine. As European governments look for answers, reports of the attacks are causing anguish among Ukrainian refugees who thought they had come to a safe space. At a Ukrainian social club in London, Ukrainian refugee Lyudmila Kazmiruk says the attacks are hitting in the most unexpected places. She says Ukrainian children in Britain are encountering Kremlin propaganda online. She feels traumatized.
I started to hate Russian language. When I hear Russian language, I just, something inside me, I'm just afraid of that person.
Russia calls the accusations of sabotage yet another unfounded accusation on the part of the West. For Ukrainians who thought they were fleeing to safety in Britain and elsewhere in Europe, the trauma caused by the often unexplained incidents is very real. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, London.
And from alleged arson attacks in Britain to artillery attacks on the battlefield, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky visited troops on the front lines as Ukraine attacks Russian power stations in Kursk. Our correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
President Volodymyr Zelensky visited the Kharkiv and Poltava regions to meet with the military close to the front line and check the restoration works of the residential buildings in the town of Derkachi in the Kharkiv region that were damaged by the Russian shelling. Zelensky held a meeting in Kharkiv to discuss security and energy issues. One of the key tasks outlined by Zelensky for the local authorities is to eliminate the electricity deficit and prepare the region for the winter. In the Poltava region, the president had meetings with Ukrainian entrepreneurs under the Made in Ukraine platform. This includes the defense industries and various other business initiatives that are working for the state and offering new products. The president reassured that the government will support these businesses and increase government orders. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian general staff confirmed that Ukrainian forces hit at least 4 power substations in the Kursk region in Russia. Ukrainian military officials said that Russian industry, which works for the war against Ukraine, is a legitimate target for Ukrainian forces. The substations that were recently hit ensure the functioning of the Russian railways, which carries out the transportation of weapons and military equipment to support the Russian army. As a result of the Ukrainian attacks, power outages in the Kursk region were reported. Meanwhile, Hungary simplified entry conditions for citizens of Russia and Belarus. Budapest included citizens of these countries in the so-called National Card program, which is issued for 2 years with the possibility of extension for those who want to work in Hungary. The head of the European People's Party, Manfred Weber, believes this decision could create serious loopholes for espionage and potentially allow large numbers of Russians to enter Hungary with minimal oversight, posing a serious risk to EU security. The Foreign Minister of Hungary, Peter Szijjártó, reported he held a phone call with his Russian and Slovak colleagues to discuss Ukrainians' decision to stop the transportation of Russian Lukoil oil through the Druzhba pipeline. He accused Ukraine of actions that, in his opinion, contradict the association agreement with the EU. Szijjártó said last week that Hungary would continue to block military aid to Ukraine until Ukrainian sanctions on Lukoil are lifted. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. On Monday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu pledged to carry out a strong response to a rocket strike that killed 12 children on a soccer field in the Golan Heights near the border with Lebanon.
Hezbollah, the Gibu Iran, Shigrain Atil Irani.
Netanyahu visited the attack site, where he reiterated Israel's accusation that the Lebanon-based and Iran-backed Hezbollah militant group was responsible for the attack. He ended by saying, "The state of Israel will not and cannot ignore this. Our response will come, and it will be severe." And in a breaking development, an explosion has been reported in Beirut. The Israeli military has confirmed that it was an attack on the Hezbollah commander in charge of the operation that killed the children on the soccer field. No word yet on whether or not that commander survived. Check our website, voanews.com, for the latest as the story continues to develop. The calculation undertaken by the Israelis of when and how to respond to this past weekend's attack was a complicated one. My colleague Michael Lippin spoke with Seth Franzman, a Jerusalem-based adjunct fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and a reporter for the Jerusalem Post.
It's definitely very difficult in the current circumstances because Hezbollah has created what they call an equation where they strike up to 10 miles within the borders of Israel in the north, and then Israel strikes back. And every time if Israel strikes further than that, then Hezbollah strikes further. So this is a kind of, let's say, mutually assured destruction concept, where if Israel does X or Y, it will get the exact response. And I think there's a lot of a careful balancing act here to not draw Israel into a multi-front war.
And why wouldn't Israel want that kind of multi-front war at this point?
Israel is engaged in a 10-month war already in Gaza, in which it has had to call up its reserves many times. It has not yet defeated Hamas or accomplished all the goals it wants to in Gaza. And I think, therefore, Israel has decided basically since the beginning that it was not going to fight on both fronts, at least not seriously. It wanted one front to be, let's say, less intense, and the other one would be the main focus. So it's plausible that Israel could shift focus to Lebanon and Hezbollah. There are certainly people in Israel that would like to do that. But so far, the people in charge have not decided to do that.
Now, Hezbollah has threatened a pretty harsh response to any major Israeli strike, but also it has signaled it doesn't want an all-out war. So how credible would you say are Hezbollah's threats to hit back hard against Israel?
Hezbollah's goal over the last 10 months has basically been to create a kind of quote-unquote right for Hezbollah to attack up to a certain distance within Israel and carve out a whole zone in which it's able to carry out these attacks basically with impunity. So from Hezbollah's perspective, this is a huge win. It's able to carry out attacks wherever it wants up to a certain distance, and Israel is evacuating its citizens. That being said, you know, Hezbollah is also very, very powerful and also positioned in a certain way in Lebanon in which it doesn't want to suffer a huge war in which it might be destroyed. So it has to kind of balance this as well. From Hezbollah's perspective, it's been winning the whole time. So it doesn't want to face a setback, and it has to be careful not to push the wrong buttons or cross a red line in Israel that would then lead to the destruction of Hezbollah.
Well, the destruction of Hezbollah is certainly something that Iran doesn't want to see, because it's the main proxy of the Islamic Republic. And Iranian leaders have been warning Israel also not to commit any major retaliation in Lebanon. So why wouldn't Israel at this point also be looking at targets in Iran?
I think there's a very careful balance going on right now, which is that both Iran, Israel, and all these proxy groups are being careful not to cross a red line or kill too many people, for instance, that would cause a much wider war. I think that if more civilians are killed in Israel, or if there's an existential threat to Israel somehow, obviously, eventually, you know, Israel would be willing to respond and things could change and there could be a regional war. But Israel also listens to all of its friends in the West, and it has to gauge the fact that it gets munitions, for instance, from the United States and Western countries. And Israel's already under a lot of pressure to end the Gaza war, and also under pressure, perhaps, that it might not get all the munitions it wants for a much larger conflict.
That's VOA's Michael Lippin speaking with Seth Franzman of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Armenia's military exercises with the United States in July and increased diplomatic contacts with Western Europe suggests that Yerevan continues its efforts to pivot away from Moscow. However, the success of those efforts depends largely on Armenia's rival, Azerbaijan, and ongoing U.S.-backed peace efforts. Dorian Jones has the story from Istanbul.
July's joint military exercises in Armenia between Armenian and United States forces is, analysts say, the latest step in Yerevan's efforts, backed by Washington, to pivot away from its Russian neighbor's sphere of influence and more towards the West. Eric Hachopian, political consultant in Armenia.
These are serious exercises, and they came, they were followed up either pre or right before with the news that there's going to be U.S. permanent representation in the Ministry of Defense of Armenia as advisors to join the French who are already there. Essentially, there's no other play but to join the West.
Armenia is landlocked and wants to reduce its economic dependence on Russia. It's pressing Turkey to open its border to provide a new gateway to Western markets. Turkey closed its border with Armenia in 1993 after ethnic Armenian forces seized the contested Azerbaijani enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh. Azerbaijani forces recaptured the enclave last year, and analysts say opening the border now could coincide with Ankara's goals to expand Turkey's regional influence. Washington is working to broker a permanent peace agreement between Armenia and Azerbaijan, with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently saying that a deal is close. With several issues unresolved, analysts say Baku sees Turkey's reopening of the Armenian border as an important leverage. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has developed close ties with his Azerbaijani counterpart Ilham Aliyev and is ruling out opening the border with Armenia until Baku's demands are met. Turkish support helped Azerbaijan defeat Armenian-backed forces. Despite that support, some analysts say Baku is dictating Turkey's policy. Doli Özel teaches international relations at Istanbul's Kadıköy University.
Azerbaijan is where it is, in good part because of Turkey's military assistance, intelligence assistance, and all that. And it is befuddling for me that Turkey cannot open the borders with Armenia, which the Armenia both needs and wants, because of Azerbaijan's veto. And especially if indeed Azerbaijan, for one reason or another, believes that its interests are once more in turning towards Russia.
Azerbaijan's Soka Energy Company is the biggest foreign investor in Turkey, giving Baku powerful leverage over Ankara. Analysts say any hope of reopening the Turkish-Armenian border appears to depend on the wishes of Azerbaijan's leadership. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Continuing their trip across Asia, Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin announced $500 million in foreign military financing for the Philippines on Tuesday in Manila. The money is earmarked for such issues as freedom of navigation and cybersecurity. Kylie Vaughn has more.
Blinken and Austin met with President Ferdinand Marcos Jr., who emphasized the importance of the decades-old treaty between his country and Washington. Blinken said the two countries, as well as other countries in the Indo-Pacific, share concerns about China's actions in the region. He also highlighted the importance of the two working together.
It's, I think, really evidence of a steady drumbeat of very high level engagements between our countries that are covering the full range of issues and opportunities that bring us together, not only security, but also economic. And we're truly grateful for this partnership.
President Ferdinand said he is thankful that the lines of communication between the U.S. and the Philippines continue to remain open. Kylie Vaughn, VOA News.
Another deadly landslide in the news, this time in India. Landslides swept through tea farms in southern India's Kerala state on Tuesday. So far, at least 93 people are known to have been killed, and many, many more are unaccounted for. The hillsides collapsed following torrential rains, sending rivers of mud, water, and boulders onto homes and makeshift tents where farm workers and their families were sleeping. M.B. Rajesh is the excise minister of Kerala.
We fear that the gravity of this tragedy is much more than these numbers. Rescue operations are being carried out on a war footing. Police, NDRF, Fire Force, and various agencies are actively involved in rescue operations.
Rajesh said those rescue efforts were hampered by a collapsed bridge that leads to the disaster zone. Army engineers were called in to help build an alternate bridge. Khartoum is not safe for women. That's according to a new report by Human Rights Watch. They say Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces have committed widespread acts of sexual violence in Khartoum, including gang rape and forced marriages in its war with the armed forces. Mohamed Osman is a researcher with HRW.
Rapid support forces in particular have committed acts of sexual violence in areas of Khartoum, definitely in the areas that they exercise control over. And it was a noticeable observation to see the connection between RSF occupying residential areas and houses and the uptick and increase of reporting around sexual violence, among other abuses. The sexual violence then became widespread, and we start seeing the trends of rape and gang rape, forced marriages and child marriages, and abduction of women and girls in areas under the RSF control. One testimony, for example, was told to us that women and girls are under the threat of rape by RSF and by SAF as well. We are afraid all the time from RSF raids into our homes. We can't sleep from this fear. Daily, there is a raid on a house. They try to rape a woman. They do not raid for just looting. They target specific houses because the women are there.
The RSF has controlled most of Khartoum, as well as neighboring Bahri and Omdurman, since the opening days of the war in April of 2023. And that's going to wrap it up for today. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.